What's up, fools?
This is the QTR Podcast. Today is... I don't even know what today is. Who cares? Because you know what? Thanks to the wonders of the internet, the marvels of the internet, formerly known as the ARPANET, by the way. More on that in a little bit. But thanks to the wonders of the internet, this podcast is going to live on forever. And with it will live my kind sponsor, Series7Podcast.com, and my buddy Franz over at Series7Podcast.com. So before I get into it, let me just give you a quick 45 seconds about why Series7Podcast.com is actually something worth checking out. Now, there's a lot of people that will read their sponsor stuff because they're provided with a script, and I was, but I will also say that I happened to check out this website after doing my last podcast yesterday, and I actually found it genuinely interesting. So if you're interested in kind of wrapping your head around more in the financial industry, whether or not you're ever going to need the Series 7 or not, it is probably cool to check this out because you'll get the basic knowledge necessary in order to get a Series 7. And now I will read the script. You know, successful investing is a result of experience, education, and luck. You can't rush experience. Maybe I won't read the script. You can't rush experience, you can't control luck, but you can acquire education. If you ever go to work in the financial services industry, you may be required to pass the Series 7 exam. This exam covers the material financial professionals. Jesus, I might as well just fucking give up. I mean, I can't even possibly charge for this, right? This one episode podcast. Look, let's just start the script over at the beginning. But the point is, oh my God, I feel like we're an hour into this podcast and I haven't read the sponsorship thing yet. This is just brutal. What you're witnessing here is learning how to do a podcast as it happens and messing up over and over again. I refuse to edit this, though. So we're going to start the script over again from our kind sponsors at Series7Podcast.com. Okay, don't make me laugh, all right? I'm going to get serious now. You know, successful investing is a result of experience, education, and luck. You cannot rush experience, you can't control luck, but you can acquire education. Boom, first paragraph down. If you ever go to work in the financial services industry, you may be required to pass the Series 7 exam. This exam covers the material financial professionals are required to master before they can talk to the general public about investments. Gotta pay the cost to be the boss. But this knowledge should not be only for the financial professionals. My friend Franz at Series7Podcast.com has put together an audio course to help financial professionals and individual investors master the material for the Series 7 exam. This material covers the full gamut of financial products and regulations, including the various equities such as common, preferred, and convertible stocks, fixed income securities, closed and open-end mutual funds, warrants, options, defined contribution, and defined benefit retirement plans, and on and on and on, including many other terms that will definitely get you laid at the bar. Trust me. Franz lets you try before you buy. You can get 5 free sample lessons by visiting his website, Series7Podcast.com. It's Series, and then the number 7, podcast.com, and signing up for the free sample lessons and related quizzes, or just subscribe to his podcast and download the lessons. By the way, that's free. So you can subscribe to the Series 7 podcast for free, which probably not a bad idea if you're interested in getting your financial education, regardless of whether or not you'll need it for this exam. It might not be a bad idea to just go and check out his podcast. If you want to take on the full course is over 58 audio lessons, which is over 25 hours of audio instruction and over 1,100 online quiz questions. So you can get your act in gear before you go take the Series 7 if you need to, or just make sure that you're proficient in all of the basics. If you want to purchase the $99.99 lessons and quizzes bundle before July 1st, 2018, which is 11 days, you can get $10 off if you use the offer code RAVEN, all in lowercase, at the checkout. So go if you are planning on taking the Series 7 for the fall. You can go and get the entire course at a discount here. You get $10 off just by using the offer code RAVEN in all lowercase at the checkout. Oh, Jesus. Looks like I forgot to turn those speakers off, huh? Butchering the advertising script here this morning. But Franz seems like a nice guy, so he's going to be all right with it. Trust me. You can learn more at Series7Podcast.com. That's Series, the number 7, podcast.com. And no joke, Franz is a sponsor, and this is a sponsorship, so this is a paid advertisement. But on the other hand, I did go to the website yesterday also too, and I found the content relatively interesting. Just as somebody that I said on my last podcast, I've looked at the Series 63 and the Series 7 just to further my own financial knowledge. It may be worth checking out. And so there you go, Franz. I promised you 60 seconds. You got 5 minutes, all right? So we'll call it even on that one, even though I was stuttering and drooling and talking all over myself for the first 5 minutes of the podcast. Okay. So what do I want to do about a podcast about today? I was at a bar yesterday. Okay. It was Friday night. No, actually, it was Saturday night yesterday. Oh, geez. I'm in great shape today. It's probably a good idea when I'm in this type of shape to put something down and record it, where it can be retrieved for the rest of humanity, and I can be ridiculed into all eternity. But you got to keep things interesting. I was at a bar yesterday, my favorite bar in Philadelphia. It's called Locust Rendezvous. So if you are one of the private investigators or business intelligence firms tasked with tracking me, that's somewhere that you'll be able to find me. Just make sure you buy me a drink before you kill me, please. With that being said, I sat down next to a guy who asked what I did, and I told him I worked in the financial industry. And of course, what did he want to talk about? He wanted to talk about Elon Musk. And he wanted to talk about how Elon Musk was just like Steve Jobs. And isn't Steve Jobs great? And isn't Elon Musk great? And I was like, shit, I got a lot of things I want to say, but I don't want to waste them on this guy here who looks like he just crawled out of a dumpster and probably is not going to retain anything I said because he's about 16 Yingling lagers deep at this point during the evening. So I figured I would come home today and get up this morning, have a nice big cup of coffee, and then I would rant into a microphone for 30 minutes till I work up a good sweat. This is good cardio for me, you know, these podcasts, because not only am I trying to get my opinions out there, but I'm doing so in a fashion that is like causing me to actually sweat sometimes. I get not Alex Jones. I'm not on the Alex Jones level of sweat. I'm not back here ripping off my t-shirt yet. But I am working up a nice, getting my heart rate up, which is good. So let's talk about why Elon Musk is not like Steve Jobs. First off, let me ask you this. When did Steve Jobs become the end-all be-all of everything? I mean, I know Bill Burr does this whole thing about Steve Jobs, and he disses him a little bit, and that's kind of funny. I recommend listening to it if you haven't. But the point is, Steve Jobs was a great innovator, okay? He turned a profit at Apple when he first started there, and he helped Apple go back to being a profitable company when he came back to it after he had Apple purchased his company, which was Next, which was the company he started when he was ousted, after he was ousted from Apple and before he came back, I think, in like 99 or 2000. But also, the guy was kind of a dick. And, you know, he denied his daughter for many years, and he was a real son of a bitch to work for. I happen to be somewhat knowledgeable when it comes to the history of Apple because I've been into the company my whole life. I was born and raised a Mac user, and so I was, you know, took apart and rebuilt my first Apple IIe when I was in like fifth or sixth grade. So I was really into it. And in kind of joining the cult of Apple that early on in, you know, the mid-90s or the early 90s, one of the things that I wanted to do was learn the history of the company, which I did over and over and over again. And this was before, I mean, there was really a cult of Apple back in the day, because in the mid-90s, when John Sculley and Gil Amelio both had their way with this company, they really fucked the company up royally. I mean, Steve Jobs wasn't doing a fantastic job when they ousted him. He had basically divided the company up between Macintosh and Apple and the two teams. And despite the fact that Apple was making a majority of the company's revenue, was responsible for bringing in a majority of the company's revenue, I think, in the mid-80s, late-80s, Steve Jobs was really focused only on the Mac team. He had gone with a bunch of engineers to the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and had really looked at what was the first graphical user interface and the first mouse setup ever. Xerox was actually the company that put that together. And the executives at Xerox didn't want anything to do with it at the time. I think that they were presented by some engineers with the idea of the graphical user interface and the idea of the mouse, and I think they didn't like it. And so what happened was Xerox, at some point in the company's history, invited Apple engineers in-house to check out all of this work that their engineers had done on the graphical user interface, and in doing so kind of inadvertently turned over to Apple what would become the Mac OS and what would really become kind of the first prominent graphical user interface. Of course, after that, Windows came right out and copied it. And Windows, of course, was a far more primitive, more disgusting operating system to use. And the fact that it was complicated kind of worked to its advantage with, you know, nerds who liked typing everything in DOS and liked using the command prompt. You kind of had DOS on PCs. You had BASIC working on the Apple IIe. And then there was this kind of race to the graphical user interface. The Mac OS was clearly the dominant of the two, just in terms of functionality, in terms of aesthetics. It was just a nicer operating system. It was not as clunky as Windows. But regardless, when Steve Jobs divided the company, I mean, he was a real dick to the people that worked on the Apple team. And this is just from knowing the history of the company relatively extensively. I mean, he demanded a lot from his employees, which is all right. But as I said in a previous podcast, you know, he had T-shirts made for his Mac team that they were working 80 hours a week and loving it at one point. But he was a really abusive guy at points. I mean, it's okay to be a visionary, and it's all right to try and want to change the world and put a dent in the universe and all these other things that he said. But he really wasn't a nice guy to the people that worked for him. And there were countless numbers of stories that I read. There was an old book before Steve Jobs was, you know, a god. There was an old book called The Mac Bathroom Reader that I had probably in the early 2000s, late 90s, that really did an awesome job of explaining a lot of the history of the company. And then, of course, there were a couple of movies made about it before Steve Jobs was god. There was a movie called Pirates of Silicon Valley that I think TBS made in the early 2000s that was gave you a really good kind of history and timeline of how things went down between Microsoft and Apple. But the thing is, Steve Jobs wasn't really a fantastic human being. I worked for Apple for a little while, and he was and still kind of is heralded as the second coming. Now, granted, when he got his shit together in the late 90s and he came back to the company and he, you know, had made his daughter a part of his life and was taking care of her and had kind of realized the error of some of his past ways, he did some really beautiful things for the company. And he helped develop and at least create the vision for a number of products that not only changed the entire ecosystem of computing as we know it, but they single-handedly helped turn around the company and turn Apple into the most valuable company in the world, which it is today. So he gets some credit for that, but also, you know, he wasn't necessarily the greatest guy in the world. So to hold him up kind of as this legend, you know what else too? I mean, there's a lot of quote-unquote legendary figures throughout the course of time that have had a mean streak in them or a bad side to them too. I guess in the case of Steve Jobs, it's good that all's well that kind of ended well. I think his daughter now is actually a journalist, I was reading at one point. But in the case of Steve Jobs kind of becoming a legend, it's just one of those things that happens. I mean, he became immortalized. You know, it's not one of these things that you can choose, which is what's really strange about the whole Elon Musk and Elizabeth Holmes type thing. Elizabeth Holmes especially, when you're wearing a black turtleneck just because that's what Steve Jobs did all the time, well, you're not really forging your own path at all. You're kind of just copying somebody else. I mean, if I go out and I paint a Picasso and I make it to the nth degree to look exactly like what a Picasso looked like, it doesn't make me Picasso, it makes me a fucking copier, you know? And so the whole shtick, of course, we know that Elizabeth Holmes now was a huge fraud, but the concept of going and replicating his outfit to try and elicit comparisons between the two of them, it's a gnarly kind of trick. First off, I guess you could say it was a nice homage to him, but really, it's kind of nasty. And you know, the thing about becoming a figure like Steve Jobs has been is that you can't try to do it. You can't try to be Steve Jobs. It just has to happen organically. you can't try to become legendary in whatever field you're in. You just have to really do what you're doing. And the consensus at some point will either, you know, immortalize you and will kind of hold you up in the annals of history, or as our friend Antoine at my office would say the first time he was reading that, the annals of history. What up, Antoine, if you're listening? Anyways, you can't choose to be immortalized as a legend. You can't. You just have to do what you do. And then organically, the public has to kind of decide that you're worth remembering in a big way or you're not worth remembering in a big way. I mean, there's 7 billion fucking people on Earth. And you can try to follow in the footsteps of these great innovators, but really all you're doing is you're just becoming a copy. And when you think about all of the people that have been immortalized in history and have become legendary, whether it's Steve Jobs or it's anybody else, it's generally because they forged their own path. And, you know, Elizabeth Holmes going out and trying to copy Steve Jobs, specifically with the way that she looked, was meant to elicit comparisons. And those comparisons were leveraged. They were leveraged into the cover of Forbes magazine or whatever it was, or Fortune, whatever she was on the cover of. It was leveraged to the tune of being able to put a $9 billion valuation on a company that nobody really understood didn't have anything that worked functionally. Until John Carreyrou at the Wall Street Journal came out and did the investigative reporting that everybody, including the early investors in the company from day one, should have been doing, not to mention the fucking board of directors. But until he came out and produced his beautiful piece of investigative journalism, the company was kind of resting on this idea that Elizabeth Holmes was a little bit like Steve Jobs, and maybe she could be the next Steve Jobs. And she's got this secret technology that nobody's allowed to know how it works. And there's this whole special sauce and nobody's allowed to ask any questions. Meanwhile, you have a biomedical company with people on the board who have little to no experience in the biomedical field for the most part. So is it any wonder? I mean, if I'm running a company based, if I'm running like Rosetta Stone hieroglyphics to English, and I got a bunch of people on the board of directors that only speak Mandarin, how the fuck are they going to know if I'm translating hieroglyphics to English or not? They have no clue. They're just going to look at these little symbols and say, all right, it works, just like the people on the board of directors at Theranos were doing. Ah, there you go. There's a picture of Elizabeth Holmes on the cover of Fortune magazine holding a tiny bit of blood in a vial. Okay, so I guess the thing works, because otherwise they wouldn't put her on there if the thing doesn't work. It's a good lesson here, by the way. It's that nobody does their own research. Everybody just buys into what everybody else says is okay. And you shouldn't do that, because at the end of the day, sometimes you're just running a $9 billion fraud. So do your own research. This was, I said this at Traders for a Cause a couple years ago. I said this at Whitney's thing a couple weeks ago. And fuck, don't listen to me. You know, there's a million people that'll tell you to do your own research. But you should just want, you should need somebody to tell you to do your own research. You should just want to do your own research. You should want to have confidence in your own decisions, in your own analytical frame of mind. So regardless, Steve Jobs becomes immortalized because of what he has done. And now there have been two main individuals that have been compared to Steve Jobs. One was Elizabeth Holmes, who we just discussed, and the other was Elon Musk. So what about Elon Musk is like Steve Jobs when it as it pertains to Tesla? I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I mean, they're both leaders, and they are definitely both visionaries. Nobody can say that Elon Musk isn't a visionary. I mean, he has visions. Whether they're a result of drinking too much absinthe or not remains to be seen. But no, he's a legitimate visionary. I mean, he has visions of an all-electric car future. He has visions of roofs that have solar panels on top of them that look like regular roofing tiles. He has visions of an underground tunnel system in LA. He has visions for the Hyperloop. He has visions of going to Mars. I mean, you can't say that Elon Musk isn't a visionary. So I guess there's some kind of overlay in the Venn diagram between Elon Musk and Steve Jobs. I mean, certainly they both have a vision. Steve Jobs said to John Sculley famously when he was trying to bring him on as CEO, hey, John, you know, do you want to work at Pepsi, sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to make history? I mean, the man had a vision. Elon Musk also has a vision. But from there, there's a little bit of a difference. I mean, Apple was a very profitable company when it first started, very profitable. And then it went through a stage where John Sculley and Gil Emilio took over and kind of ran the company into a ground and into the ground rather and fucked up the financials a little bit. But for the most part, Steve Jobs, and if you go back, you listen to some old lectures where Steve Wozniak is talking about when he first met Steve Jobs, he would talk about how Steve Jobs, I think when he was like 17 or 16, he used to work for a company that would sell surplus electronic parts. And this is back in the day, so we're not talking about all of the technology we have now. This was the 70s, right? So he would tell stories about Steve Jobs going and buying like 100 switches for 6 cents each and then turning them around and selling them for $6 each because he either had an in with the guy who was selling them, or he just knew that people on the outside would pay more because they didn't really know what the surplus price of these electronic components were, you know, switches and resistors and whatever it was that they were using back in the day. So for early on, Steve Jobs had a, and I think at one point too in some lecture, Steve Wozniak says he actually objected to the fact that Jobs was turning around and selling these fucking things at such a huge profit. Which, you know, that's an argument unto itself. But the point of the matter is that Jobs was focused early on, at least on turning a profit. And when Wozniak was making blue boxes and making red boxes back in the day and kind of fucking around with all these little inventions that he was making because he was, you know, really ahead of his time, Wozniak, it was Jobs' idea to take these things and to monetize them. I remember Wozniak saying it would cost $75 to make a blue box and Jobs wanted to turn around and sell it for $150. And of course, Wozniak was appalled by this. You know, Wozniak was just doing it for fun. He was making these things because he knew how to and because he was a genius. And this is the kind of stuff that geniuses do when they fuck around with electronic components. If you don't know what a blue box was, by the way, back in the day, a blue box used to be a device that was basically almost like the keypad to a payphone, to like an old payphone that you would walk around with, and it would attach itself to like a little speaker. And what you could do is you would put the speaker over the speaking end of the payphone. And the way that it used to work was when you wanted to place a phone call or you wanted to place like a long distance call from a payphone, I believe what would happen is the operator would actually, whether it was a physical operator or whether it was automated at the time, would generate a certain hertz tone that would actually be played into the phone that could enable the phone to place a phone call. It would let them know either that the call protocol was approved to then go ahead and make a long distance call, or that some blue boxes also, I think, and maybe they weren't blue boxes, but maybe they were black boxes, I believe, would also generate the tones that payphones made when you would put quarters or dimes or nickels into the payphone. So anytime you would place a quarter into a payphone, if you held the end of the payphone up to your ear, you would hear a little did-did-did-did-did-did-did-did-did. And by replicating those tones and then playing them back into the mouthpiece of the payphone, you could trick the payphone into thinking you had put a quarter in when you hadn't. And a blue box used to, I believe, play this 2600 hertz tone, which was a tone that I believe would open the phone up somehow through the protocol of a payphone, would enable the phone to allow you to make a long distance phone call for free. It would basically, the phone would override and believe that the operator was approving a long distance call, and then you would be free to dial. So Steve Wozniak was making these little boxes that basically allowed you to hack payphones, or they used to call it phone freaking with a PH. And I believe the way that they found out actually that the 2600 hertz tone worked was they at some point, the Captain Crunch cereal used to come with a little toy in it, and there was a whistle that made a 2600 hertz tone that they used to pack into the Captain Crunch cereal. They didn't know that's the tone that it made, but they were just, you know, they were distributing a little plastic whistle to kids who bought their cereal, and inadvertently somebody found out, probably some nerd, that when you blew this tone into the phone, it allowed you to make free long-distance calls. And then from there, I think it was reverse-engineered to try and find out what the tone was, and then that was replicated. So the point is, Steve Wozniak used to make these little blue boxes, and it used to cost him, I think, like $75 to make, and Steve Jobs said, holy fuck, you know, we can stick it to the man, and we could turn around, and we could sell these things to people, and we can make a profit doing it. And that's what they did. I think they were at Berkeley when they did that. I don't know. My history isn't perfect. I know Steve Jobs went to, I think, Reed College at one point, but I think they were also at Berkeley at some point, right around the time that this blue box thing was going down. But he decided he wanted to turn a profit off of it. And Steve Wozniak didn't care. I mean, he just liked fucking around with this stuff. He was a programmer. He used to program his own automated joke lines where people would call and a pre-recorded message would tell a joke. I mean, that was a huge deal back then. Nobody had systems that could do that. But Jobs was always focused on the money. He was really the salesman. I mean, everybody that knows Apple knows that Wozniak was the guy who produced all of the bits and pieces to the Apple computer. He was the programmer. He was the electronics genius. Jobs had some limited electronic acumen. He used to know the basics. And I think at one point Jobs was actually employed by, I think he was employed by Atari at one point. And then I also know that, you know, Wozniak was the guy who had programmed Pong, and Jobs had taken his idea also to Atari to try and monetize that. So Jobs was always focused on making money, always from the get-go. He may have came out and said he was out to change the world, but at the end of the day, you know, he was a very good negotiator and he was a very good salesman, and he knew that if they could make something for $75 and sell it for $150, that obviously that was great business. And similarly, as goes the story about the switches, if they could make them for 6 cents and he could turn them around and sell them for $6, even though Wozniak was appalled, you know, Jobs knew that as a way to scrap for some cash. And so he was a shrewd, really, businessman. He was a shrewd salesman. And Apple was able to go public after a while because they produced some ungodly number of revenue from the Apple II. You know, they did the Apple I first, which was basically a box that, you know, it was an old wood box that you could hook up to your television screen, and I think it had BASIC on it, and that was the only thing you could run. And then from there, the Apple II was really the first, like, mainstream computer that had the monitor and had the whole setup, and everything was built in one case and whatever. And they sold a fuckload of these Apple IIs, and the company instantly became insanely profitable and instantly became cash flow generative and instantly became a financial success. So there's really your first difference. I mean, Musk has a vision here. He has a vision to go out and create an all-electric car future, but as far as it relates to, look, they're both visionaries, but as far as it relates to profitability, which is, you may not like it, it may be the uncomfortable side of business that you don't want to talk about, but at the end of the day, if you want to run a business, at some point you're going to have to be profitable. And so Apple was very profitable early on, and Tesla has not been profitable. It has not been consistently profitable at all. Hasn't even been close to that. There's been one or two quarters where they've done some adjustments, and they have posted, you know, non-GAAP cash flow positive numbers, I guess. But in terms of consistent profitability, there was a huge difference between the early days of Apple and the early days of Tesla. Huge. And again, let us not forget the fact that you can't choose whether or not you're immortalized. And I get the impression from Musk that he wants to be immortalized. I mean, I think to some degree he's going to be. The public consensus is that, you know, Elon Musk is going to kind of go down as a visionary and a leader for change. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. He's certainly got the nation thinking about electric vehicles more. He's certainly amplified the discussion about alternative energy. All of these things are good things. So I'm not going to give the dude too much shit for that, like some other people would. But as an investment, let's talk about as an investment. I mean, what do you want as an investor? You want a return on your invested capital. So when Mike Markula from Intel cut Apple a check when they were still in Steve Jobs' garage for whatever, I think it was $250,000 back in the day, he saw a return on his invested capital because these motherfuckers started cranking out the Apple II and they sold a load of them. And it wasn't after like the first or second presentation that they had like their first licensed dealer overseas, and the floodgates just opened. And actually, the Apple II continued to sell incredibly well even after the Macintosh was introduced. So again, Musk is a visionary. No doubt the guy's a visionary. But in terms of implementing and executing from a business standpoint, there's a big difference. There's a very big difference. And what Steve Jobs did was, you know, he had the vision for the Mac. He divided the company up between the Apple team and the Mac team. He pretty much neglected the Apple team. I think after John Sculley came on, the company found itself divided. And Sculley, I think, wanted more consistency with the Apple team because Apple was bringing in the money. And Jobs wanted to push in the direction of the Mac, because he saw that the graphical user interface was really where the future was going to be. So again, with the visionary stuff, in that case, it turned out that, you know, John Sculley was making the decision based on money, and Jobs was making the decision based on kind of forging a new path. And the decision to go with the Apple team and oust Jobs ultimately was the wrong decision, because that led to financial ruin for the company for the most part. Whereas if Jobs had been left in charge to kind of implement the Mac strategy in those years, who knows what would have happened. For those of you that want the history lesson, Jobs went on to form his own computer company that was called Next. And the Next operating system was based on Unix architecture. And Next was really ahead of its time. It was a graphical user interface that had a lot of components that the Mac OS today still has in it, such as integrating email directly into the operating system, which back then was unheard of in the mid-90s or the early 90s when he was going through. And actually, Next's operating system with the Unix kernel became Mac OS X. So when Jobs came back to the company in 98 or 99, he came back as a result of Apple acquiring Next. And then basically Jobs took over as CEO and took all of the principles and concepts from the Next operating system, which was called Next Step, and he took those principles and made them into Mac OS X. And so Mac OS X, which was the first Mac OS that kind of have the Unix kernel at its core and is still a derivative of the Mac OS that's used today, that was really the big paradigm shift for the Macintosh operating system. So when Jobs came back in 99, he kind of knew what direction he wanted to take things in. He wanted to simplify the operating system. He wanted to simplify the computers. That was when the iMac first came out. He came up with iTools. He came up with iTunes. He came up with the iPod. And all of a sudden, here we are, like 18 years or 19 years after Jobs has returned to the company, and they're the most one of the most profitable companies in the world, and they are one of the largest companies in the world. They're sitting on $200 billion in cash in the bank, and it's Warren Buffett's biggest position. And I can tell you what, if Elon gets to that point where the company is generating so much cash that it literally doesn't know what to do with all the cash it has in the bank, and when Warren Buffett is going on national television and just swooning over your company saying, I wish we could buy more, but we can't because we're stuffed to the gills, then I'll tell you you've made it. Then I'll tell you, all right, maybe we should talk about immortal status at that point. I think Musk will be immortalized to some degree, but I think there's a lot of differences between him and Steve Jobs. I really do. I think I just get this impression that immortalization is something that he yearns for and that he wants. And I'm not sure that Steve Jobs really wanted that. Regardless, though, Jobs ultimately led Apple down the path to where it is today from a financial perspective. And you know, he raised some money. To the best of my understanding, they raised some money from Mike Markula, who was from Intel, and he was an early kind of investor in the company, and Jobs sold his VW van, and Wozniak sold his HP scientific calculator, I think, to get Apple up off the ground, which, by the way, those back in the day were worth several thousand dollars, I think, in today's money. So they did that to kind of invest in themselves. And they may have done a secondary or something after they came to the market initially. But from the get-go, coming out of the gate as a public company, I'm pretty sure they were just generating a lot of cash because the Apple II was in very high demand. As they moved into the late 80s to the early 90s and the Apple slash Macintosh feud started to happen and the Scully days and the Emilio days, a different story, ultimately culminating in Microsoft taking a 7% stake in the company, I think, at one point. I think that was right when Steve Jobs came back, and they were really looking for direction at that point. I remember they were licensing the operating systems to other companies that wanted to produce Mac computers. There was a company called UMAX. There was a company called Power Computing that used to make Mac clones. That eventually got phased out, but they were really scrounging for ideas at that point. Musk is going to have to prove that he can deliver. Now, he's going to have to prove that he could turn a profit. I mean, I've gone through so many podcasts and talk about how important profitability is, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here. That's not the point of this podcast. Thought this was an interesting comparison that I wanted to make some notes on. But at some point, he's going to have to prove that this company can turn a profit. And out of the gate with Apple, that wasn't an issue with Steve Jobs. So very different stories, the two of them. So let's stop saying Elon Musk is going to be the next Steve Jobs, because he's really not. I mean, he might be the first Elon Musk, and maybe people in the future will say he'll be the next Elon Musk, meaning who knows what that'll mean in the future. Guy who has a fantastic idea and then drives a public company into the ground, or guy who deals with unbearable scrutiny once his company goes public and is unprofitable but somehow manages to scrape it together and turn it around. That story has yet to be written. I could talk about the fact that a couple other executives left Tesla. It was reported yesterday, but who even cares at this point? God, I'm so fucking tired about talking about executives leaving that company. And like I said, it's not like unrest is completely crazy at companies like these. There was unrest at Apple between the Apple and the Mac team, and just as I believe there to be unrest at Tesla. I've speculated that many of these executives have left because the tone at the top might not be super friendly. It might be. I could be talking out of my ass, but it might not be. Either that or there's some type of crazy operational deficiency at the company that is just making people yearn to want to leave. I don't know. I mean, when did Jobs and when did Wozniak turn around and sell their stock and exit Apple? They did when I think Jobs sold his stock when he was ousted from the company. I remember that. And he sold everything but one share, I think. And I think it wasn't a ton of money. It was like $70 or $80 million worth of stock, I think, at that point. And this is one of the things that I talked about with Tesla. Now, you want to talk about where there may be some common ground. If the proxy contest that's going on winds up going in favor of shareholders, and shareholders wind up kicking out some of Musk's board members that have been more than fair to him and more than kind to him, and some independent board members come on that are not related to Elon Musk, there could be a situation where Musk ultimately finds himself possibly being forced out of his own company. Now, it's a really sketchy scenario. Like I said, in the case of Apple, John Sculley wanted to force out Steve Jobs because he wanted to stick with the profitable product at the time, which was the Apple II. They were still selling a shitload of Apple IIs and billions of dollars in revenue, I think, a year back in the early 90s, late 80s. I think we're talking 89, 90 here. But I remember, I believe they were doing billions in revenue just from the Apple II, which back then is a lot of money. And they were profitable. So Sculley wanted to go down that road. thinking like a businessman, and Jobs wanted to create the Mac, thinking like a visionary, and thus we had reached an impasse. In the case of Tesla, who knows what would happen if Musk wound up being ousted from the company, or if he winds up just moving into the CEO role. Or, I'm sorry, if he winds up moving out of the CEO role and just into the chairman of the board role, what would happen? What would the effect be? Or if he changed to chief technology officer? I don't know. I get the feeling that Musk wouldn't like that. And so when on a previous podcast I made the guess that that could be a situation where maybe Musk sees himself blowing out of his stock, I think I kind of got that idea from what had happened in the case of Apple subconsciously, because I knew this history where Jobs had just blown out of all of his stock and kept one share so he could go to the annual general meeting and help himself to the continental breakfast and be a pest and say, I'm still a shareholder. I still have rights. But it would be interesting to see what would happen in that type of situation. But stop fucking saying Elon Musk is the next Steve Jobs. I mean, if you want to learn from something, learn from Elizabeth Holmes. Is Elizabeth Holmes the next Steve Jobs? Well, no. One ultimately helped create the world's largest and arguably most profitable company that is possibly one of the most fundamentally sound companies in the world right now. The other one advertised one thing and did another and found herself being charged with fraud. Yeah, but they both wore black turtlenecks. All right, well, I guess if that's your criteria, then they're very much alike. But as I put out on Twitter several times before, too, the other next Steve Jobs magazine covers have all been going to Elon Musk. So will he be the next Steve Jobs? Who knows? He's got a tall order ahead of him. In terms of immortalization, he might be close. He might be getting there. He'll definitely go down in history one way or another. This is like Jose Canseco put on his Twitter the other day. I'm launching the Canseco coin ICO. If you know any ICO lawyers, get in touch with me. I was like, yeah, lawyers will definitely be getting in touch with you. Don't worry about it. Elon Musk is definitely going down in history. Definitely. The only thing we have to determine is how he's going to go down in history. If he can turn this Hindenburg around and put the flames back into the balloon and help propel this thing back up another 5 or 10,000 feet, which, by the way, I don't think is impossible. If you haven't heard my last podcast or two podcasts ago where I did one called Tesla Could Swing 50% in Either Direction, you should listen to that because I talk about a potential bull case and a potential bear case. It'd be fucking difficult, but I don't think it's impossible. If he could do that, I would even go one further as to say if he can turn this company around and turn it into a massive profitable enterprise and turn it into the energy company that he wants to make it, he may go down on a par with Steve Jobs. But we're talking, we need 10 or 15 or 20 years worth of operating history before anybody starts making comparisons like that where it starts to make sense, in my opinion. You got to say, in my opinion, I always say that. It's nice to just let people know what your opinion. By the way, this is a good time to remind you that this is not investment advice. And we have a strict 2-drink minimum, which, by the way, if you have not been adhering to the last couple of podcasts, you may notice that they may have been a little dry. So my advice to you would be to lubricate yourself and consult your nearest bottle of whiskey if you have one. With that being said, I know that that's a little bit late to do the 2-drink minimum reminder now that we're 43 minutes into the podcast. But whatever, I do things my own way. All right. Don't fuck up the works. I'm just trying to make it through the day here. So anyways, let's stop comparing Elon Musk to Steve Jobs until we see what Elon Musk does. Let's see how the next 5 years goes. Maybe we'll do an update to this podcast in 5 years. Probably won't be the last time I talk about Tesla, but maybe this will be the last time I talk about the Musk and Jobs comparison. We've already seen Elizabeth Holmes. Next Steve Jobs? No, you're a fraud. Okay, bang, one down. Now, Musk, it's up to you. If you're going to carry the Jobs torch forward, then it's time to start operating, time to start generating a profit, time to start generating some cash. And I got to tell you, what Jobs did from a business perspective was exceptional. To be ousted from your company, to find the investors to start next, to really conceptualize the strength of an operating system using Unix as its core and implementing all of these things that nobody had really thought of implementing into a personal computer interface and doing it with a really sexy look. By the way, Next was like one of the first really good looking operating systems. It was 3D. It was really beautiful to use. I remember just looking at old Next boxes, and the computers themselves were actually really nice. There was one called a Next Cube. It was a little, you know, like 12 by 12 cube. So even back then he had the focus on the design, which Johnny Ive would eventually take over at Apple. The two of them saw eye to eye on design and aesthetics and simplicity. But the problem with the Next Cube was, I think it was like $9,000 when it came out. So it was just impossible for people to buy. It certainly wasn't a retail product. So when Jobs came back to Apple, he took all of the concepts that worked and all of the nice things about that operating system and put it into a box that people could use. And that was really the first iMac running Mac OS X. So we'll have to see. Maybe the problem is that Tesla IPO'd at a different point in its history than Apple. I don't know, but Apple, I think, they weren't around that long before they started generating a profit. It wasn't the Apple One they sold out of. I don't think they did tremendously well on the Apple One at all. I remember they pitched it to a computer shop, but the guy didn't like it because there was no monitor. It wasn't an all-in-one. It was just a bunch of basically circuitry in a box, in a like a homemade wooden box with a keyboard. But when they got the Apple II, man, they nailed it. They nailed it. And that was it. And that's kind of what the Model 3 was supposed to be, right? The Apple II was the product that took Apple from research and development, unprofitable company that requires capital to operate, to bang, hit with consumers, hit with the mainstream, hit with schools, hit with personal users, hit with everybody. And then, you know, there was the 2GS, the 2E, but the Apple II was the model that really pushed Apple over the edge. And that's what the Model 3 was supposed to be. The Model 3 was supposed to be Tesla's mainstream product, the one that we're going to sell so many of them, we're going to make it up in volume. You know, it was supposed to be a $35,000 consumer car that anybody could purchase and anybody could afford. And they were supposed to be ubiquitous on the road. We're going to see them everywhere. Except the problem is, as Montana Skeptic said on a couple previous podcasts, the price tag is higher than $35,000. It's over 50. It's over 60. And they're selling all the high margin vehicles first is what I meant to say. Now, before they even get to selling the quote-unquote consumer version, the $35,000 version, which the margins are going to be terrible on, Musk is already out yesterday talking about, well, the new dual-motor Model 3, and it's going to be, whatever, $80,000 or $70,000. So who knows? And also, this is not like a case where Apple just had Microsoft and IBM to worry about. And really, it was Microsoft. Steve Jobs fucked it up because he thought IBM was the enemy. But really, the enemy was Microsoft at the time. And actually, back in the day, when the first Macintosh prototypes were being developed, Jobs actually welcomed Bill Gates to Apple to show him the Macintosh. And then when the first Windows prototypes came out before the Mac had launched, I think it was in between the Lisa and the Mac. When the first Windows prototypes came out, Jobs flipped out on Microsoft. And he was like, you know, look, I fucking showed you guys this stuff that, by the way, I stole from Xerox. And you guys rushed and got it out to market first. So that was just one competitor he had to deal with at the time, Microsoft. And on the other hand, Tesla has numerous competitors. You want to hear them all? Go watch Mark Spiegel's presentation. It's on YouTube somewhere that he just gave at Whitney Tilson's event 2 weeks ago. I think the presentation is called Tesla is Still a Zero by Mark Spiegel. It's like two slides of introduction, two slides of have a nice day, and in the middle, it's like 155 slides of Tesla's competition. It's all auto manufacturers. It's all the different makes and models and price points and options of electric vehicles that are making their way out there. So in that regard, Tesla is very different than Apple was back in the day. I mean, Apple had one competitor and they kind of slithered in front of them. And because Gates was so smart to just get Windows to market first, even though by the standards of Mac users at the time, it was such a pile of shit. I mean, Windows still is to some degree a pile of shit. It's gotten much better. I actually use Windows now. I use Windows 10. It's okay. It's bearable. But just the fact that he got it to market first was the most important thing. And because he beat them to market, that was it. Windows took off. And Gates dominated. And the fact that Apple was then looked as being behind the eight ball, even though Apple, as they got past System 6 and got to System 7, the graphical user interface got a little bit nicer. You know, all of the models were in color at that point. It was just nicer to use. But then Windows 95 came out, and it was just like, Katie, bar the door. See you later. Nobody cared that Windows 95 copied pretty much everything that a Mac had. I mean, it just had a taskbar instead of a toolbar on top. So it took the menu bar and it moved it down to the bottom of the screen. Nobody cared about that. Nobody cared about the fact that their graphical user interface was this nice coat of paint that was running over this pile of shit DOS that was still kind of underneath it all, you know, archaically running everything. Because they got there first. And because they got there first is what made Bill Gates the richest man alive. And it's what made Bill Gates be the guy that had to go to Apple and bail them out and buy 7% of the company in the late 90s when Jobs came back. I actually don't know when he cashed that out, if he ever did, but if he held on to that, he did all right, huh? So that was just one competitor. Tesla has a lot of competitors to deal with. And they're big, and they're cash flow generative, and they're international names, and they're all over the world. So let's stop comparing Elon Musk to Steve Jobs until we see how things go. All right? Let's just see how it goes. Let's give it 5 years, 10 years, and then we'll look back. And if you want to call me an idiot 10 years from now, because Musk has made a fool out of me, I hope he does. That means a lot of investors that I think today may be at risk of losing capital have done very well. I'm okay with getting carried out on the short trade. Wouldn't be the first short trade where I got my balls stomped in by the stock market. It's okay. I'm all right with that. I've had it happen enough, and I'm old enough, and I understand how the system works well enough to be okay with losing money. To be honest with you, I'd rather, you know, it would be nicer to see a bunch of retail investors make money, even though they don't know what they're investing in. But the problem is, I just don't think that that's the likely scenario. So let's see how it goes. You guys think about that for a little while. And I'm going to remind you about Series7Podcast.com before I sign off. So my buddy Franz over at Series7Podcast.com, I'm looking at his ending script here. I think it's the same as the opening script. I don't know. Remember, I think it's the exact same thing. I don't know. Well, anyways, I'm going to read it anyways. So this Series7Podcast.com, it's series and then the number 7. podcast.com. By the way, go check out the site. Okay? It's free to go check out the site. You don't need to pay for anything, obviously. And there's a lot of free content on there. So if you want to just sign up for the free podcast, if you're interested in getting a financial education and just bettering your knowledge of financial, just bettering your financial and business acumen, regardless of whether you're a personal investor, whether you work in the field, it's worth checking out and worth checking out his podcast. Successful investing is a result of experience, education, and luck. You can't rush experience, you can't control luck, but you can acquire education. If you ever go to work in the financial services industry, you may be required to pass the Series 7. This exam covers the material financial professionals are required to master before they can talk to the general public about investments. But this knowledge should not only be for the financial professionals. My friend Franz at Series7Podcast.com, that's Series, the number 7podcast.com, has put together an audio course to help financial professionals and individual investors master the material for the Series 7. This material covers the full gamut of financial products and regulations, including the various equities such as common, preferred, convertible stocks, fixed income securities, closed and open-end mutual funds, warrants, options, defined contribution, and defined benefit. Defined benefit, retirement plans, and on and on. It just reminds me of the part in Boiler Room where the guy's like, I have a Series 7. And he's like, get the fuck out of here. Look, the best thing about Franz is he lets you try before you buy. So you can get 5 free sample lessons if you go to the website. It's series7podcast.com. You can sign up for the free sample lessons, the related quizzes, or, like I said earlier, you can just subscribe to his podcast and check it out. Just go and check it out. Subscribe to the podcast, series7podcast.com. Listen to it. If it sucks, you can turn it off. If you like it, you can hang with it. It's something new just to check out. I'll probably check out an episode sometime over the next couple days when I go for a run. See, that's the nice thing about sponsoring the QTR podcast is I like to be intimately involved. That's gross sounding. Anyways, the full course, it's 58 audio lessons. It's over 25 hours of audio instruction, and it's over 1,100 online quiz questions. If you want to purchase the lessons, they're $99.99 for the lessons and quizzes bundle. Before July 1st, 2018, that's not 11 days, that's a month and 11 days, by the way, you can get $10 off by using the offer code RAVEN, all lowercase letters at checkout. And for more info, you can go check out series7podcast.com. That's series, the number 7, podcast.com. And Franz is a good guy. He's somebody I met last week. I've enjoyed speaking to him. I'm glad he's sponsoring the podcast. And his website is fantastic and very informative. I would definitely go check it out. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, it is Sunday. The Philadelphia Phillies are playing baseball. There is an NBA playoff game on later on today. And do you guys really think I got all day to just sit around here and talk to you? I mean, come on. All right, maybe I do. But anyways, I'm out of here, folks. I'll catch you guys early this week. Peace.